It's Wednesday, November 6th. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this is The Daily Dive. Horrible tragedy in Mexico as at least 9 Americans, 3 women and 6 children from a prominent local Mormon family were killed by drug cartel gunmen. Authorities in Mexico say that it may have been a case of mistaken identity, and the targets were a rival drug cartel. Pilar Melendez, reporter at The Daily Beast, joins us for what we know. Next, student surveillance services are constantly monitoring the emails, homework assignments, pictures, and even chats of students for any sign that they might be a danger to themselves or others. Gaggle is one such service that is monitoring about 4.8 million students across the country. Caroline Haskins, tech reporter at BuzzFeed News, joins us for how Gaggle is watching everything your kids are doing. Finally, STDs are at an all-time high, and a new study is showing that people are trying to crowd-diagnose what they have by asking people on Reddit. People enjoy the anonymity and speed of the internet, but doctors worry that a misdiagnosis could lead to ineffective treatments and further spread of a disease. Julia Naftalin, health reporter at Insider, joins us for more. It's news without the noise. Let's dive in.
I agree with the president when he says Mexico has to really knuckle down and go after some of these cartels and stop this escalating level of violence, and hope that if there's a way we can help in that effort, that we're called upon to do so.
Joining us now is Pilar Melendez, reporter for The Daily Beast. Thanks for joining us, Pilar.
Thank you so much.
There were 9 members of a Mormon family killed in Mexico in what seems like an ambush. At least 3 women and 6 children from a prominent local Mormon family there were killed. They seem to be the members of the LeBaron family, who have dual Mexican-American citizenship and have been settled in the northern part of Mexico for a long time now. Pilar, tell us what we know about this attack and this tragedy that happened there.
So far, we know that 3 sectors of this family and 3 different cars were heading. One was going to Phoenix, and one was going to see some more family in Chihuahua, which is a little bit more north. And they were ambushed. Of the 3 vehicles, and with 14 children in between, only 8 of them have survived. 5 of them are currently in Phoenix seeking treatment. We don't really know right now the extent of their injuries, but the Mexican authorities have been pretty on the ball trying to figure out what's been happening. They've said that it's probably a case of mistaken identity, that probably some local drug cartels thought it was a rival gang and ambushed them. Some reports are coming out right now that these women were pretty vocal that they weren't members of a cartel, but were shot anyway. Mexican authorities have not confirmed any of that, but have said that they are pursuing all leads at this time.
Now, these 3 cars were not all together. There was a few miles separating them. Police has said they found about 200 spent shell casings from assault rifles and other weapons at these various crime scenes. The reports coming out of what happened seem horrible. They said that there was a child that was shot as they were running away. There was 8 people that survived the attack. I mean, a lot of those were children, and they had to hide on the side of a road. And I think one of them was a 13-year-old boy who covered his siblings with brush there so they wouldn't be detected. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is horrible stuff we're hearing.
It's really terrible. And the fact that these kids, 13 years old, trying to take care of his 6 other siblings, walking 14 miles to their camp in La Mora, and then his 6-year-old sister, scared that his older brother had died, went out to go look for him and got lost. It took authorities several hours to find this 9-year-old and the rest of these 6 other siblings. A lot of them injured themselves. It's all pretty terrible. And the fact that we don't know what's going on, a lot of these family members that I've spoken to today are making it pretty clear that they're very peaceful and they have made no efforts to cause any trouble with local cartels. And this wasn't a direct attack, but just senseless violence.
What have we heard from officials? I know President Trump is ready to declare war on the cartels. He's just waiting for the president of Mexico to ask for help in that sense. But the president of Mexico himself says, we don't need that. We're going to handle this ourselves. What has he been saying about this?
The Mexican president's been pretty clear about the fact that he doesn't want any U.S. help. He's saying that that would just cause war, and that's the worst thing. He did say, though, that he was planning to call President Trump today to discuss the massacre because some of these victims are dual citizens. But he said that he is trying to do everything with local authorities, and he's trying very hard not to include the United States in any way other than passive information.
Tell us a little bit about the Mormon family that has settled there for some time now. Early reports are that they're kind of an offshoot of the Church of Latter-day Saints. They're unaffiliated with them, and they moved into Mexico so they could practice polygamy, although a lot of reports say that has since faded even from these other groups. But this family in particular, the LeBaron family, has been there for a long time, and they've even had problems in the past with cartel members.
As you mentioned, the fundamentalist Mormon communities that are in northern Mexico right now started coming from the United States in the late 1880s because they wanted to practice polygamy that was obviously abolished around that time. The family members that I've spoken to that are part of the LeBaron family say that they don't really practice polygamy anymore. There's obviously some offshoots in the Mormon community in Mexico, but they do not themselves practice it. The LeBaron family itself is pretty well known. From what I'm gathering, in 2009, Eric LeBaron, who was one of the wealthier family members there, was kidnapped in a stance to detain any other kidnappings in the future. The LeBaron family refused to pay his $1 million ransom, and he was eventually released. But then only a couple months later, his brother Benjamin, so in July 2009, was fatally beaten and shot to death in front of his family for his stance against anti-violence and for refusing to pay his brother's ransom. So in terms of turmoil between local cartel factions and the LeBaron family, they're pretty high right now. So I think a lot of family members that I've spoken to want to make it known that they haven't done anything to provoke this.
Right.
And this is just a senseless hit.
Pilar Melendez, reporter at The Daily Beast, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Gaggle has saved us both an incredible amount of time and money while providing a service that puts us in really good standing with our parents and all of our board members. We've now shifted our resources into areas where we're supporting learning rather than supporting basic issues of safety.
Joining us now is Caroline Haskins, technology reporter for BuzzFeed News. Thanks for joining us, Caroline.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to be talking about the new economy of student surveillance. One of the biggest players right now is Gaggle. What they do is basically go over everything, emails, tons of different correspondences, and they scan all this stuff for indicators of violence, mental health crises, things like that. Then they'll alert school administrators or police if they have to, that something might be wrong with a student. Caroline, tell us about Gaggle and how much surveillance is going on for students now.
I feel like it's important to note that being a student in 2019 means having like not just a school email address, but having a school associated either a Google G Suite or Microsoft 365. So this means that when you're making like documents, calendar events, spreadsheets, PowerPoints, or talking to your friends, like all of this is associated with your school account. So where Gaggle comes into the picture is it uses two in-house artificial intelligence scanners to go over pretty much any keystroke or anything that a student does as a part of school. So for instance, it has a text scanner and it's looking for things like profanity, references to harassment, but it's also looking to predict things like self-harm or like suicidal ideation. And it's also scanning images for possible pornography, whether it's like professional or student produced. It's important to note that a lot of kids don't really realize the extent to which they're being watched. To some degree, we're kind of mindful of what we say over email, but if a student says like a curse word in a Google Doc a couple of times, it'll get flagged to school administrators. So it's really bringing the whole idea of total surveillance of a child to new heights. And while Gaggle has been around for a long time, it's been in business since 98, it's expanded in recent years to be compatible with Google G Suite and Microsoft 365 and such, and to offer all of these services. And in exchange, it's promising schools that it's not only going to help kids become digital citizens or be mindful of what they do online, but they're telling schools that it can help them save student lives. It says in the last year, we've prevented 722 student suicides. And it's a very enticing claim to make for a school. But as I sort of went over in my article, certain privacy experts have raised the alarm on this logic of surveillance that products like Gaggle are perpetuating in school systems.
Is there any type of opt-out or opt-in situation for this? I mean, if a school signs up for this, they're going to pay for the service. It's on. It's working. But for individual students, can they opt out if their families want to?
So Gaggle does technically offer an opt-out option, but the reality is that it's kind of technically difficult to implement. So for instance, if you opt out of Gaggle, you won't be able to use your school email. You won't be able to use Google Calendar, Google Drive, anything associated with school. You won't be able to use that if you don't agree to be monitored by Gaggle. On a practical level, it's kind of unclear how that works because in a lot of school districts today, if you're a student, you have to use these accounts.
And this is only official school use platforms. I mean, it's not tapping into a student's social media or cell phone, is it?
Gaggle, while it doesn't monitor kids' social media, if a kid hooks up their Twitter account or some other notifications to something associated with school, then Gaggle will pull that information in. And sometimes this could also mean seeing private chats and DMs from people who don't even go to that school.
The system is set up to flag all sorts of different types of content, things in the context of possible self-harm, you know, words like suicide, cut myself, end my life, take my life, things like that, and even other questionable content that's a little more general. When the system flags a student for this, it almost works kind of like the Facebook content moderating where they have a level one team set up to flag low level stuff and it gets passed up the ladder to different levels and in varying circumstances of severity also.
A lot like Facebook, Gaggle does have a team of content moderators. They always have a couple people on the job 24/7, and that's the big selling point that they sell to schools. So their level one representatives, their job is to basically go over anything and everything that's flagged by Gaggle and determine if it's a false positive or not. So if a student, for instance, like quotes To Kill a Mockingbird, then the moderators are supposed to say, oh, that's a false positive, it doesn't matter. But they're also supposed to go through like all of these other different things. And usually these people are paid about $10 an hour. They're contract employees, meaning they can work anywhere. And they're not officially entitled to certain company benefits like health insurance and such. And if there's an instance of like questionable content, meaning something that could involve bullying or what Gaggle calls a possible student situation, which means a student is at so-called imminent risk of being harmed, that means it's flagged to a level two representative. And Gaggle didn't get into detail about what sorts of qualifications these level two associates are required to have, but they're supposed to review the things that could possibly involve a more serious situation with a student.
This program is not cheap. It can cost anywhere from tens of thousands of dollars, $12,000 to $60,000 possibly. Their big selling point, as you mentioned, they said they saved 722 lives. Most of those, I think, were suicides that they could have possibly prevented there. And you mentioned this whole notion that critics might have of the surveillance state and not really letting students make mistakes, things like that. But what do parents say about this?
So the interesting thing is that Gaggle does not have to get permission from parents in order to operate within a school system. So it's likely the case that a lot of parents don't even know that this is happening behind the scenes. And obviously it makes sense from the standpoint of student administrators. They're not exactly an employer in that student makes them money, but it does benefit them to know more about students because as one of the experts that I talked to, Sarah Igo, said, schools are kind of this training house for the person. And so especially when you start involving topics like suicide, which are obviously really difficult to tackle. And so when Gaggle is saying we can possibly offer a solution, then it's a tempting offer for schools. But as some of the experts pointed out, there's risks in escalating situations too early. Like one of the adolescent mental health experts that I spoke with pointed out that if a student's suicidal ideations is escalated to teachers or even to the police at the improper time, that could worsen their symptoms or even make them less likely to reach out for help. So a lot of this and dealing with adolescent mental health is about like making sure that the appropriate power is in the hands of the student to sort of like take charge of their own care, so to speak. And the thing about Gaggle is that it's extremely well-intentioned in that it really genuinely does want to like help save student lives. But the question is it actually doing that? Is it actually helping students trust in doctors, authority, and healthcare systems in the long term? And that's a little bit more unclear.
Carolyn Haskins, technology reporter at BuzzFeed News. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of shame and stigma that can come with having an STD. So a lot of the times people might be thinking, oh, it's easier for me and less embarrassing to just do this behind a screen. And then there's also this idea that taking a picture or writing a message on Reddit takes a fraction of the time it takes to call a doctor.
Joining us now is Julia Naftalin, health reporter at Insider. Thanks for joining us, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
We have a new study out right now with some disturbing news in there. People are trying to diagnose their STDs by going to Reddit. It's something called crowd diagnosis. And doctors are worried that it could be making outbreaks of STDs even worse. Julia, tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so this study just came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the doctors who conducted the study were looking at the message board STD on Reddit. And they basically tracked all of the messages that were sent from November 2010, when Reddit launched, through February 2019. And they found that starting in November 2018, the number of messages on the board started to double, and 58% of the people who were posting on that board were explicitly requesting other people who were members to help diagnose their STDs. And it's pretty wild.
Yeah, and 30% of that 58% even posted pictures of their symptoms to help along with the process of diagnosing. So a little gross, a little unsettling. But part of the study is that people oftentimes, they like the anonymity of it. They'll get a quick response. I think on average, people would get a response within 3 hours. So it's a fairly quick turnaround. That is also something that worried doctors, because a lot of people are pointing to, you know, what are we doing wrong that people would rather go online to get these diagnoses?
Right. The doctors who did the study did point that out, that, you know, there's a lot of shame and stigma that can come with having an STD. So a lot of the times people might be thinking, oh, it's easier for me and less embarrassing to just do this behind a screen. And then there's also this idea that taking a picture or writing a message on Reddit takes a fraction of the time it takes to call a doctor, book a doctor's appointment, which doesn't mean it's better, but that's just what these researchers believe are some of the reasons why people are trying to take care of themselves this way.
So people are going to the site to get these diagnoses without ever going to the doctor. And this was what I thought kind of was a little interesting, also a little perplexing, that they would go to a doctor, but apparently not satisfied with what they were told there. I would think the doctor would be the authority on it. Why would people want to go back there? From one of these other articles that I found, they quoted somebody and they're saying, my results showed HIV-1 confirmation. I think my doctor might be wrong. Do you think I have this? You know, it's like if your doctor is telling you you're ill with something, that's who you should be trusting. Why would you continue to go online?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think it's, like I said, a mixture of the shame of having an STD, especially HIV. Like, there's a lot of stigma, unfortunately, around that, when there shouldn't be. So I could see someone being like, well, that can't be me. I'm not a person with HIV, you know, taking it into my own hands. And then also just there's the current state is a lot of people just don't trust their doctors. There's a big mistrust. So they might just be falling into that disbelief for that reason.
What's the takeaway from this for doctors? It seems that they feel like they might need to approach this in a different way. They say they might want to go to Reddit and maybe try to get an awareness campaign going instead.
The researchers kind of said that even though this is alarming, this could be used for good if Reddit and other social media platforms work to stop the spread of misinformation and kind of use it as an educational tool for doctors, basically, of like, these are the STDs people are writing about most, or the symptoms people want to know more about. And then that way they can provide better resources for their patients so that they won't feel like their only option is to get a crowd diagnosis on a social media platform.
Julia Naftalin, health reporter at Insider, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's it for today. Join us on social media at Daily Dive Pod on both Twitter and Instagram. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of The Daily Dive was produced by Victor Wright and engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this was your Daily Dive.